This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, September 18th, 2008. From KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Tandasizwe Shimaringa sitting in for Auro Bogado. A new study suggests more links to disease from a chemical found commonly in plastics. Factions in Zimbabwe have finally come to an agreement on the direction of the country, and inmates in Tijuana rebel over inhumane conditions. Those stories and more, but first, these headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the headlines. Defense Secretary Robert Gates says the U.S. is re-examining its strategy in Afghanistan. The announcement comes as British newspaper The Independent reports that the Pentagon is seeking to take over command duties from NATO in the Afghan war. Gates flew to London from Afghanistan to meet with other NATO officials today. Those talks will continue tomorrow. More American troops have died this year in Afghanistan than at any other time since the October 2001 invasion. The Food and Drug Administration has released draft guidelines for approving genetically modified meat for human consumption. Leon Caldwell reports.
The FDA draft guidelines tell industry that genetically engineered animals, like cows altered to produce an antibiotic, must go through a strict regulatory process. However, those animals labeled low risk, such as those used for research, get a pass. The FDA says all altered animals for human consumption must be FDA approved. But consumers who want to avoid genetically engineered steak will have a tough time. The new guidelines don't require such labeling. Doug Gurian-Sherman, scientist from the Union of Concerned Scientists, says that animals will face more rigorous oversight than genetically modified crops. But he says the public will not know what genes are altering the animal's DNA.
We will not even know what the agency is regulating, what the animals are, how they've been altered.
The public has until November 18th to comment on the FDA's draft rules. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Israeli Foreign Minister Tzipi Livni has begun the process of putting together a new cabinet after her election yesterday to replace outgoing Prime Minister Ehud Olmert. Olmert tendered his resignation amid allegations that he accepted bribes from an American businessman. Livni defeated her rival, the hardline former defense minister Shaul Mofaz, by a one-point margin. Mofaz announced today that he will take a break from national politics. Bolivian President Evo Morales opened talks with opposition figures today in the city of Cochabamba. Lenny Oliveira has more.
The dialogue between the Morales administration and opposition leaders will address two of the main issues that have been fueling the increasingly violent opposition protests for the past month. One is the issue of challenging gas tax revenues to social programs for senior citizens. The other is the pending nationwide referendum on a new constitution. Religious leaders and representatives from Organization of American States, the United Nations, and the Union of South American Nations are acting as mediators. Despite the peace talks, 15,000 small farmers and coca growers continue to blockade access points to the province of Santa Cruz, demanding the resignation of the provincial governor for his alleged role in orchestrating the destruction and looting of central government buildings during an opposition protest last week. Representatives from Bolivia's influential social movements say if the Cochabamba peace talks fail, particularly with regards to the constitutional referendum, their support bases will march on Santa Cruz. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Lenny Oliveira in Cochabamba, Bolivia.
The fourth most populous U.S. city continues to struggle in the aftermath of Hurricane Ike, with electricity, emergency assistance, and gas in short supply. Meanwhile, many residents of the nearby beach community of Galveston have been unable to begin the process of rebuilding their island homes. From Houston, Rachel Clark has more.
Galveston Mayor Lyda Ann Thomas extended her emergency powers for another week yesterday, while health officials continue to warn the island city's 60,000 residents not to return until further notice. The city had to abruptly cancel its so-called look and leave policy after Tuesday's announcement that residents could return to survey damage immediately created a massive 15-mile-long traffic jam along all three Galveston-bound lanes of Interstate 45. The scene repeated itself on Wednesday with miles of frustrated motorists using what little gas remains in the Houston area, only to be turned away at the bridge leading to the island city. Officials estimate there are still between 250 and 300 holdouts on Galveston Island, despite the lack of clean water, power, and flushing toilets. The Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, has established about 60 distribution centers around the Houston area where thousands of people are now lining up for drinking water, bags of ice, and other items. Reporting from Houston, I'm Rachel Clark, Free Speech Radio News.
And those are the headlines. I'm Shannon Young.
The death toll has risen to 23 people after a second riot broke out yesterday at the Tijuana State Penitentiary. Some 8,500 inmates are housed in a building currently operating at well over 200% of its original capacity. The first uprising came Sunday after a 19-year-old inmate died from a blow to the head inflicted by prison guards. After word got out about his death, both family members and inmates decided to confront authorities in what they say is systematic abuse, torture, sexual molestation, and threats. For many, the riot was long coming due to the deep tears in the Mexican judicial system, where justice is still rarely available for the poor, and rampant corruption and political interests still dictate privilege for the few. Mariana Martinez has this report.
The first of the two Tijuana jail riots lasted more than 12 hours, leaving four people dead and dozens injured, including six police officers. A second riot happened 2 days later when inmates complained about lack of water and food. That riot led to the death of 19 others. Some say the riot started after 19-year-old inmate Israel Marquez Blanco was beaten to death by guards after they discovered a cell phone and drugs in his cell. Blanco had been in jail for car theft. According to human rights officials, his body has clear evidence of torture. Mayra Marquez Blanco is Israel's sister.
He was all beaten, full of scars, handcuffed. They placed a book on his belly and then hit it with a baseball bat. He died from a blow to the temple, and that's why my brother died, from a strike to the head. That's why we have all this destruction, because they say the way in which they killed him.
Alicia Aguilar Dávalos, president of the Inmate Family Member Committee, has long been asking for guards to be investigated when abuse and bribery claims occur. She, along with the Human Rights Commission, have documented at least 10 incidents of torture, including anal rape with a broomstick, officers placing plastic bags over an inmate's head who was then submerged in bleach, and electric shocks to the genitals as punishment for not giving bribes to guards.
I sounded the alarm 10 times, letting them know this is happening. They are torturing them. They are beating them. On Tuesday, I blew the whistle that the inmates in the cells are on hunger strike because they completed their sentence and they still don't free them. And then when they went on hunger strike, they just started beating them much worse, beating them wildly, and this just fueled the fire, of course.
The Tijuana prison, known as La Peni, is the most overcrowded in the country. But Human Rights State Commissioner Francisco Javier Sanchez Corona says overpopulation is not to blame. For him, the real problem lies in the procurement of justice, which is slow and elusive. Another problem is authorities haven't created an environment for rehabilitation in jails, as it is required by the Mexican Constitution.
We're convinced that this problem of crime should not be attacked and will not be solved with more police or more guns. It's a problem that's rooted in the fact that the people lack opportunities in terms of work, culture, and health. And that's what's generating this huge problem we face.
The governor has now removed the three top jail officials and has promised to launch an investigation, but that does little to alleviate the systemic problem. The United Nations Crime and Justice Institute for Latin America states that in Mexico, the prison overcrowding is 126%, and less than 42% of the inmates have an actual guilty verdict or sentence. According to an investigation by Milenio newspaper, only 1% of crimes in Mexico end up in someone being sentenced. Judges see a rate of just 12 cases per month, and more than 50% of inmates are jailed for a non-violent crime with a $50 bail. But most of them are poor and can't afford the bail. Days after the riot, authorities are still struggling to account for all the inmates who ended up in different cells and buildings. 250 of them have been moved to other jails. There's a hand at the coroner's office nobody knows who it belongs to. Mayra and her mother are grieving, as 22 other families will be when they find out their loved one is dead. For them, the promise of reform or justice is a hollow one that came too little, too late. From Tijuana, Mexico, this is Mariana Martinez for Free Speech Radio News.
Following a power-sharing deal by Zimbabwe's three main political parties on Monday, Zimbabweans at home and abroad have adopted an approach of cautious optimism. President Robert Mugabe and two leaders from the opposition's Movement for Democratic Change have agreed to work together following 6 months of protracted talks. FSRN's Davidson Mudzingwa reports.
Party divisions and party labels no longer matter to the people of Zimbabwe. We must all unite to solve the problems facing this nation. Our new government recognizes the hardships faced by the people today, and addressing these issues will be our main priority.
The new Prime Minister of Zimbabwe, Morgan Tsvangirai, on Monday set the tone for a new beginning in a country hard braced by economic and political problems for a decade. An opposition leader with the Movement for Democratic Change, Tsvangirai will chair a council of ministers and oversee the formulation of policies. President Robert Mugabe with the ZANU-PF party retains his post but with reduced powers. Although the 84-year-old leader still chairs the cabinet, he can no longer take unilateral decisions. The power-sharing deal was also signed by leader of a smaller MDC faction, Professor Arthur Mutambara. The agreement has restored hope for a better future for struggling Zimbabweans. Many believe Tsvangirai is acceptable to the international community, and this will open doors for aid and humanitarian assistance. Selina Moyo is a Zimbabwean exiled in South Africa's coastal seat of Cape Town. She hopes for jobs, food, and better health care.
I feel very happy because I think everything is going to change. Everything is going to improve. We're going to have food, medication. Our children are also going to go to school.
But for others, the unity government is unlikely to solve Zimbabwe's complex problems in the foreseeable future. Bram Yenekom leads a refugee rights group, People Against Suffering, Suppression, Oppression and Poverty. Yenekom believes Zimbabweans will continue leaving their country, seeking a better life in neighboring countries. He says Zimbabweans in exile will watch closely before returning to their native country.
We can only hope for the economy to turn around, and if it does, then the first thing we'll see is a reduction in the number of people migrating into South Africa. So long as immigrants in South Africa and into other African countries surrounding Zimbabwe see an influx consistently coming through, if they see more and more faces coming, then their hope their hope of returning to Zimbabwe is still a distant memory, a distant dream. We don't expect a reduction of immigrants coming into South Africa anytime soon. Zimbabweans in South Africa are extremely skeptical. The genuine refugees, we believe, should actually constitute a vast majority of Zimbabweans abroad, still know that they will starve to death if they go back to Zimbabwe, and that the economy and the politics around Zimbabwe are far from being solved.
South Africa is a preferred choice of Zimbabweans seeking a better fortune away from home. Another refugee rights advocacy group, Zimbabwe Exiles Forum, estimates some 5 million Zimbabweans have been forced out of their country. Meanwhile, the three parties are now discussing how they will share the 31 ministries earmarked for the new government. Sources say all parties are battling to control crucial ministries such as defense, finance, and home affairs. The European Union said it will observe the progress in Zimbabwe before taking a decision on whether to lift targeted sanctions and channeling aid to that country. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Davidson Makanga in Cape Town, South Africa.
In the wake of last month's Democratic National Convention, a series of civil lawsuits and internal police investigations are underway due to alleged police misconduct. Arrested protesters are alleging mass arrests during the first day of the convention were unjustified, and police illegally seized and destroyed their picket signs. However, the case of a Denver police officer assaulting a protester on camera is taking center stage, with the city conducting its own investigation. Blake Wesley files this report from Denver.
An internal police investigation is being conducted over the actions of a Denver police officer who assaulted a Code Pink protester during the Democratic National Convention. A video circulating on YouTube shows Officer Scott Stewart ramming his nightstick into Alicia Forrest's head in an attempt to make her move away from a group of police officers. That crack you heard was Forrest being hit by the nightstick, then falling to the ground after being knocked unconscious. She laid on the asphalt motionless for several minutes. Richard Rosenthal from Denver's Office of the Independent Monitor is heading up the investigation.
This case certainly makes an allegation of excessive force against a protester by a Denver police officer.
Once Forrest regained consciousness and rose to her feet, she was surrounded by police officers who proceeded to arrest her on charges of interference. Meanwhile, surrounding protesters chanted the words, "Let them go." Attorney David Lane and the Recreate 68 Alliance are also filing a civil lawsuit on her behalf. Recreate 68 co-founder and protester Glenn Spagnello alleges another protester, Carlo Garcia, was also assaulted by the police on the scene.
They were talking passively to the police officers before they were actively attacked by those police officers. Carlo had sustained injuries, and Alicia was actually knocked unconscious by the police officer's baton for asking where Carlo was being taken when he was being arrested.
In a statement issued by Code Pink, Forrest says she was trying to support a fellow activist and stand up for a right to free speech. Attorney David Lane says the video of Forrest being hit by the officer will make for a stronger case.
The video clip speaks for itself. She was standing there peacefully talking to a police officer who called her a bitch and cross-checked her with his baton, sent her flying. You can see it on YouTube if you access Denver protest Lady in Pink.
However, Lane criticized the city and the Office of the Independent Monitor for not taking a more active approach to hold the officer accountable.
What Mr. Rosenthal is spending all this time investigating is unclear to me. I want to know why Mitch Morrissey, the Denver DA, has not filed assault and the second-degree felony charges against that officer.
But Rosenthal says before they can jump to any conclusions, they need to conduct a thorough investigation.
This case, it's under investigation. We've got to be objective about it and evaluate it based upon at the conclusion of the investigation, and I'm not going to reach any conclusions one way or the other before the investigation's completed.
Meanwhile, Denver Mayor John Hickenlooper remains silent on the issue and has been praising the police for a smoothly run convention. Reporting for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Blake Wesley in Denver.
As the Wall Street bailout list grows, the worries of ordinary Americans grow as well. Will the money in your bank be safe? Recently, Sheila Bair, the chairman of the FDIC, the agency that insures deposits, released a statement saying U.S. banks are overwhelmingly safe and sound, but with the current financial crisis, many wonder if the FDIC will soon need help from the government as well. And if the government bails out another financial entity, where will the U.S. get that money from? FSRN's Karen Miller follows the money track of who might have to bail out those who are bailing out someone else.
It's been 2 days since the government announced the multi-billion bailout of U.S. insurance giant AIG. And Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi has a new set of questions.
$85 billion. Where's that money coming from? What is its impact on our deficit? Why, if this one of the reasons why they had to bail out AIG was because of foreign banks and in both Europe and Asia were saying that they had such a stake in AIG in their own countries. Well, where are they? Why are they not participating in this bailout? So we want to know, what is the impact on our budget and our spending, our investments in America? What are the why are these foreign financial institutions not participating in this bailout if in fact it related to the stability of their markets?
How the recent government bailout could trickle down from global markets to Americans with money in the bank remains to be seen. With the instability in the markets, some even question how long the FDIC, the federal institution that insures bank deposits, can hold out. Even though only a few banks have failed so far, there's a growing list of more that could be in trouble. On Wednesday, FDIC Chairman Sheila Bair testified before Congress.
To be sure, there is no single solution or silver bullet that will bring an end to the market turmoil. Rather, a multi-pronged effort emphasizing different solutions for the different segments of the market is required.
Which raises the question, if the FDIC goes down, who will bail it out? In the late 80s and early 90s, the U.S. Treasury stepped in. At that time, many banks went under. Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson, however, has recently said, quote, "The American people can be very, very confident about their accounts in our banking system." FDIC officials also say that 98% of U.S. banks are still meeting regulator standards. However, the FDIC fund is currently below the minimum set by Congress. This has some Americans wondering, if the U.S. Treasury has to bail out the FDIC, where will the U.S. Treasury get the funds to do it? Robert Engel is professor of finance at the Stern School of Business at New York University. He says the U.S. Treasury could do it a couple of ways.
Either directly from tax revenue or from selling government debt, which is the way the government runs a deficit. And this would be done by an auction that would be open to investors all over the world.
Which is why the U.S. continues to keep up vital investment relationships in the midst of the financial crisis. Today, the U.S. signed a 10-year bilateral agreement with China. U.S. Treasury Secretary says it's vital for these relationships to continue.
I provided an update on U.S. financial markets and described the steps we have taken to address immediate market stresses, as well as medium-term steps we are taking to address policy issues arising out of recent market turmoil. We agree that while the turmoil of recent months has created difficulties, the future prosperity of all our peoples requires that we fully participate in global financial markets to balance our economies and fuel growth.
Congress is calling for hearings to be held in the upcoming weeks to examine the issues around the current financial crisis. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Karen Miller.
Bisphenol A, or BPA, is widely used as a lining in food and beverage containers, particularly plastic. The chemical has been said to be linked to incidences of cancer and obesity, and now a new study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association has found even more links to disease. FSRN spoke with Dr. Anila Jacob of the Environmental Working Group about those new links and what they mean.
Bisphenol A has been studied for the past decade or so. And there are scores of animal studies showing that very, very low levels of exposure, meaning real-world levels of exposure, are linked to diseases like breast cancer, prostate cancer, infertility, early puberty, obesity, diabetes. And we're really worried about children's health because we know that with this particular chemical, formula-fed infants have really high exposures because BPA can be found in baby bottles and it can be found in infant formula. So we know that they're the most highly exposed population. We also know that children on average have 2 times the exposure of adults. So we're concerned because this is a chemical that's been shown to be harmful in animal studies and there's widespread exposure among the U.S. population.
Can you tell me what are some of the obstacles that you and other scientists and activists have encountered in trying to limit BPA exposure?
Sure. Well, let me tell you where BPA is found. BPA is found in canned foods, and it's found in certain plastic bottles. It uses the lining in metal cans. And so from the lining, it can leach into the food that's in the can. And, of course, it's found in certain bottles, especially baby bottles. Now, we know that the chemical industry has said that the studies that are showing harm aren't very good studies. Now, they've put forth their own studies performed by the chemical industry that show that this chemical is not harmful. However, we think those studies are faulty. We have scores of studies from academic scientists, you know, independent labs from universities all across the world showing that this chemical is harmful at very low levels. And now we have a human study showing where people with higher levels of this chemical have increased rates of heart disease and diabetes. So it's all a very concerning picture. We know that certain manufacturers of baby bottles have taken actions. Retailers like Walmart have taken some of these products off the shelf. But the FDA really needs to take comprehensive action to benefit people all over the U.S.
So that was going to be my next question. What role has the FDA played in the use of BPA and BPA exposure?
So the FDA put out this draft assessment a few weeks ago, and they had a public commentary period. And they had a meeting that was this Tuesday. So at this meeting, we presented on behalf of our organization, and there were representatives from a number of public interest groups. All of us were pretty much in agreement that the FDA draft assessment was not done correctly because they were relying too heavily on the industry-funded science and not giving enough weight to the independent studies that show that this chemical is harmful. So some of the tips we have, especially if you have an infant in your household, would involve switching from the liquid infant formula to powdered infant formula because we think that that has less BPA in it. And we also recommend using the BPA-free baby bottles that could be either the plastic bottles that are labeled as BPA-free or glass bottles. And really, again, with infants, we're so concerned about their exposure, and we really want to try to decrease exposure in that population.
That was Dr. Anila Jacob, a senior scientist with the Environmental Working Group. 100 college and university presidents and chancellors recently joined forces to encourage a national discussion on reconsidering the legal drinking age of 21. Their Amethyst Initiative contends that the 21-year-old drinking age is not working and has created a culture of dangerous binge drinking on their campuses. In this edition of Street Beat, WMNF Community Radio's Sean Cunan spoke with undergraduate students at the University of South Florida in Tampa. He asked the students age 18 to 23 whether they thought the drinking age should stay at 21 or be changed.
I think it should stay at 21. I just turned 21. I waited my, you know, the time that I had to wait.
I think it should actually be lowered to 18 because, to be perfectly honest, whether or not they have stringent laws on drinking or not, college students are still going to be drinking whether or not they're 21. Reducing it to 18 would probably also reduce the pressure that comes with thinking that I'm in college, I can do what I want, I should start drinking because there's nobody looking over my shoulder.
I think it should stay at 21 because I think there's other issues that are more important than like drinking and the age it should be. And honestly, people drink anyway, even though they are underage. So I don't think it's going to change anything.
I believe it should be lowered because at the age of 18, we're considered adults and we are responsible for our actions. We can be sent to war to die for our country. We can decide who the president is. So I believe that we should be able to take care of ourselves under the influence of alcohol.
It really wouldn't make a difference if they changed it to 18, then just a lot more people would be socially accepted to drink, but people drink anyway, so it really doesn't make a difference.
I think it should be lowered to 18, again, with the we have the right to die for our country and right to vote. We're considered adults and we're on our own, so we have the right to take care of ourselves and drink whatever we choose to drink.
I think it should be changed to 18 because when you're not allowed to do something, you're just going to want to do it more. So basically everyone in college is 18, and if you're allowed to drink, then it's not such a big deal.
I think it should stay at 21 just because although we're 18, we're not as mature as people think we are, and there's a lot of kids that pick bad decisions, and it could fall in death or car accidents and stuff like that. I think 21 is a good age because it shows that we're maturing. So as we get older, we know and we understand that if we pick a bad decision, that we're able to suffer the consequences as adults and human beings.
I think that it's kind of ridiculous that we're 18 and we get everything except to be drinking. So I think it should be lower to 18. But I do kind of agree that our minds don't really mature till we're 20. So I understand where they're coming from, but I think it should be lowered.
That was Danielle Shortridge, Jeff McCullough, Rachel Albright, Van Johnson, Shannon Michael, Chris Romeo, Michelle Selby, Stefan Moore, Ariane Moffitt. Those voices were recorded and produced by WMNF's Sean Cunan. You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News, which is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. You can send your feedback to comments at fsrn.org. From KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Tandasizwe Shimaringa, sitting in for Aldo Bogado.